Okay.
So we have been exploring the material in mindfulness and action. We're continuing on this. We have just gone over the four foundations of mindfulness. I was wondering before we go to the next topic if there are any questions from last week or previous week that thought that might be just shared, brought up, comments or observations. Okay. Touch and go. So really, these are very, very specific meditation instructions, and I think that this is really about what this book is really about, is just the actual practice of meditation and the development of mindfulness and the way to understand how mindfulness can integrate into our lives. So the main question that we're touching now is the notion of, well, it talks about attitude, but it's cultivating an awareness of mind. So we were introduced to the mindfulness of mind last week. And now we're going to explore further how we actually can relate to, acknowledge, and understand awareness of mind. And the way we do that is basically by using this technique of touch and go. So the most important thing about touching is to be completely willing to open up and lean into what arises. In other words, we're a mess. Right? I mean, this is just a state of affairs. As we look in our mind, we realize we're just a bunch of neurotic bundles that are screaming for attention, you know, like switching channels on a TV, a bad TV set. Or it could be a very good one. I mean, you never know. Sometimes you can have great reception and actually get very absorbed in the stuff that comes up. But the important thing is to really be willing to open up. And I mean, I think the difficulty, as we discover, is that it just seems to just be endless. You know, there's no high bottom to this.
don't try to get a job in sales.
So, you know, and that's actually okay, you know, frankly, because it means that we have been touching on the notion of the difficulty. One of the, now that meditation is becoming a public commodity and a way for a number of people to make money and develop apps and other kinds of gadgets that will somehow allow everybody to become a meditator and learn how to really understand how to be really there with it all, you know, and feel really good about it. You know, that's a real seduction. Particularly after you've just been sitting here looking at in a vomitorium you call your mind.
I mean, right? That quote, in a vomitorium. Wow, that's awesome.
Well, I mean, this is just the simple truth, but the fact is, you know. I mean, you know, we actually attract people by talking about how terrible it all is. We start with the Four Noble Truths, you know, and you know, initially that seems like it's all very depressing and bad news, and you know, yeah, well, now what could be worse? But actually, it's much better to get the bad news at the outset.
They might have a hard trip. This guy off the stage.
So, So then, the whole point is that, you know, as we develop more of a frequent acquaintance with this kind of regurgitation process and stuff that just is going on, it's just the way our minds are processing. You know, it's not like something's wrong. And actually, one of the difficulties we have is assuming that something is wrong. You know, we start looking at the way, if you went into your bowels and had to see how basically matter stuff was being transformed, going out from the lower intestine into the bowel, you know, you might find yourself slightly discomforted. I'm sorry, I was just coming up. But that's just the way it is. You know, it's just a natural process, right? It's like it's not like it's something that's not supposed to be there. And so likewise, looking at the bowels of our mind, which is basically going on all the time. And by doing this, we don't have to be dragging out, taking stuff that doesn't belong in our mouths and our brains and assuming that that's something we are supposed to be expressing and sharing with other people. It takes care of itself. It's doing its own process of just basically processing itself. And so as we get more acquainted with this, we could develop something which, because you've heard this term, CCL, couldn't care less. You know, I mean, it's like there's some quality of basic relaxation and dropping it, you know, as when we see it. It's not like we want to hang on to it. It's more like we want to be able to completely open and connect with it, and then we can drop it and let it go. We just simply abandon it and go on. We discovered earlier, many of us were studying the first skanda and how the five skandhas, and this is basically the heaps of impulses and energy fields that sort of constitute the nature of what we call being oneself. And the first skanda, which is just this kind of series of continuous discontinuity of this flickering process of on, off, and creating this instability, this sense of unease, and this sense of fundamental disturbance, which is basically the foundation of our problem. If we think we have a problem, or if we actually look and find the basis of our problem, it's because, you know, we're not accepting continuous change. And change is what's always happening. And very subtle and extraordinarily minuscule processes, but continuous. And so this letting go is a training ourselves from, as it were, the top down, at least where we are with our conscious mind, to be able to actually begin to drop what's the stuff that comes in and go on. And we're not trying to change it. We're not trying to make it better. We're not trying to fix anything. We're letting be. So that's very important. Now we...
But couldn't care less sounds, it doesn't, it what's the word I'm looking for? It doesn't sound, it sounds complacent, as opposed to just be.
Well, I mean, we're not worried about the consequences of what just went through our heads.
Okay.
At all. That's what we're training in. You know, we're not interested so that this huge turd that just came through my brain is leaving an imprint.
Right.
and I'm getting involved with worrying about it and, you know, making it up against my usual notions of... Well, listen, I mean, we can use more flowery language and talk about all the wonderful things that we get distracted in, but it's the same thing. We could get distracted with a movie we saw, which was just absolutely captivating.
So what's in this chapter? What's it say in this chapter?
Yeah, the touch part.
Yeah, it says,
what are we touching?
We're just touching basically the experience of our mindfulness, and mindfulness in the sense of being there and experiencing what's happening, and then as it is, and then we go, we let it go. So, you know, this goes into this next point, which is basically...
Now, what does it say there?
What does it say? You want me to quote something?
Sure.
We can use the phrase touch and go to describe the cultivation of mindfulness and awareness. Mindfulness in this case is being mindful of the sense of being. The touch part is that you are in contact. You're touching the part of being there, actually being there, and then you let go. This approach applies to awareness of your breath and the practice of meditation, and also applies to awareness in your day-to-day living situation. So, okay, I was a little extreme in my illustrations, but in the practice of meditation, touch and go works with how we directly feel our experience. So, it's very interesting. we can actually feel with our mind. And, you know, we talk about the term think with your heart. We can also feel with our mind. We can actually feel the experience. I mean, I don't want to, it's not intellectual, it's actually just being open and realizing that our minds and our hearts are, we talked about how this is where it is. It's here, not up here. We're not analyzing. We're actually just open, directly
so
open.
So when we touch our experience in meditation, are we hanging out there a little longer? Are we investigating it? Or are we just aware of it?
So I think initially we're simply letting everything be, go forward in the initial stages. Well, we're giving, you know, talking about meditation instructions, your first instruction is to simply work with your being present and allow yourself to open, and also then just simply, whenever arises, simply relax and allow your mind to mix with your out-breath. So that's the first step. As we go forward, we're talking about awareness now, which is actually starting to actually pay more attention to the content that actually comes up. And we're actually looking at it and actually willing to see it and not just dismissing it. Like we talk about labeling, and that could be in the at least initial stage, it's just a form of getting beyond and staying here, you know, or returning here and getting out of distraction. But here we're talking about actually going more deeply into investigating.
What does that mean? Like, what is investigating like?
Can you find anything in this book?
Yeah. So, what he said that, you know, he says to acknowledge and look at it, but again, that's like, that's a very short phrase. Like, how would that be? So I'm sitting and it comes to me that I was really harsh to someone today.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm just letting go, I would just say thinking. I'm thinking about something that happened.
Right.
If I was looking at it, I'm just asking what would be different.
So, okay, the difference is this, that we are actually opening up to feeling the texture. We're actually not, and we're actually exploring. We're not going into great detail because we're just here. We're just, you know, we're not turning this into an analytical session.
Right.
But there is a witnessing, and this can be very immediate. Remember, one of the things we're doing in the meditation practice is simply being here. But we're learning about what being here means, which is a larger context. It's not just an abstraction. It's actually experiencing what's going on and acknowledging that.
So could you do a little, taking Elise's example, but you just go a little step by step as to what exactly that means. With the example that she had of she's sitting, this kind of awareness comes, it's mm-hmm. full body, I would assume that it's in the mind, it's in the body, an awareness of something that occurred. And rather than just call it thinking, what then? Could you delineate what then? How touching that, what touching that, and feeling the texture of that?
Well, there's some things in the book that deal with that, aren't there?
Good. I just would like to help.
The motion section seems to be covering that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's
like
where we are.
So can someone find that?
Yeah, find it. Okay.
I don't have a book.
You actually have a really good one here. If you feel that sitting and meditating and coming back to the breath is a way of avoiding problems, that is the problem. You might feel your practice is extremely kosher, good, sensible, and real. And you don't have to pay any attention at all to those little embarrassments that happen around your life. You can regard them as unimportant and just come back to the breath. If you do this, you are creating a patchwork. You are bottling up problems and keeping them as your family heirloom. Instead, it is important to look at those embarrassments and only then to come back to the breath.
So I'm asking, can we talk about what it means to look at those embarrassments?
That's
what I'm trying to get at.
It's a different from... I thought of labeling, dropping something.
Linda? I thought about how to do that. And in past meditations, I found labeling with a word, like not just the thought, but anger, anxiety, feeling insignificant, whatever. I would use a word sometimes to acknowledge it. And then another technique, which I think came from listening to something from the children, was when a feeling came up, to actually go into feeling it with your body, not here, mm-hmm. but in your body.
So there are some things that are, some things are somatic. Yeah. Some things actually are body-oriented and actually are coming from your body or resonate in your body.
Right.
And some things are basically just spinning.
Well, but thoughts, they're together. Let go of the mm-hmm. thought and feel it with your body is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So simultaneous, actually.
Mm-hmm. It comes on simultaneously, but go of the thought and feel it with your body. Don't follow a storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Feel that.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the pain that goes with some thoughts.
Yeah.
And just feel that thought and let go. And I find that really, I don't know, sometimes I really like doing that.
It feels sometimes when I've, been aware of that, it feels for me like I open up. I kind of like I have my lid is closed and my lid says okay, and it opens up and it's like okay, I'm gonna go there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like to me. But the thing is that of course I witness, the little thoughts that trickle down as a result of opening. It's like this constant. It's like this. It's the pulse. The back and forth. That's what it feels like.
So all of that, which is basically very individual and personal, and at the same time, we're treating it as one thing. We're simply treating it as thought. Thinking. It doesn't mean that we don't feel and we don't have experience of sensations and we don't have anguish or anything else. But we actually are willing at this point to simply treat it as thinking. And because the whole notion of what we have of mind is much bigger at this point. Mind is not just some kind of abstract thing out there. Mind is what we experience. There's nothing we actually experience that's not mind. Right? So that's how it's possible to consider this thinking during our meditation practice.
But then we let go.
Absolutely.
So that's, it's not like we layer on some technique on top of it. So that is, the instruction isn't to add on, but just to hang there a little bit. You know, like sometimes it's like a thought will come up and you, there's sort of a sinking feeling or something like, oh, you'd rather avoid it. But there's just a momentary allowing that feeling to be there, and then you're letting go. You're, that go part is really important because you're not solidifying it or adding any other story on it or a technique on top of it.
Yeah, you can also have a mirthful quality, you know, when you just sort of start, something hits you funny and you could get into that. So, I mean, we open up to it, and then, but the thinking, when we do this thinking, it's an acknowledgement of, oh, an event, you know, and we're dropping it. The thinking helps us drop it. It helps us just simply recognize what's going on. And we're fundamentally relaxing at that point.
I had a moment today at work that was anxious, and I had to particularly anxious, and I felt it come up, and I thought of actually a kind of quote that triggered me to look at it, and I did. So I said, okay, I'm going to look at this. And I closed my eyes. I'm on the phone, closed my eyes, and I tried to look at it. Find it. And, but what was interesting is just really trying to look at it and realizing it's not there. My anxiety just started to come down, and then I moved on. But it was almost like you said, don't solidify it. When I stopped the story, I realized there was nothing really there. I'm looking for a thing, kind of like, but it wasn't a thing. There was nothing there.
Well, that's a key point. In fact, that's the next step. So we're introducing the notion of just looking. And as we look and as the space opens up for us and we realize even in the very instant there's an opportunity to not only simply acknowledge and see, but actually you're investigating. And when you actually look for where the thought arises or where it dwells, you can't find it.
Right.
And so that experience itself is the actual Vipassana experience. So there is some sense of, as we learn, first we're just going on, you know, breath. I'm here, bingo, it's gone. You know, I'm here, right? But as we go further, we'll begin to understand this is actually what thought is. We're learning about the nature of thoughts. We're learning about all this stuff that can completely take us over. You know, it's like a chimerical kind of situation. And by simply looking directly into it is how we learn. So that we're not going to be captivated, we're not going to be ensnared, and we're not going to be controlled. That's the training. There is a purpose to all this. This is not just sort of doing this because I've got nothing. We have nothing else better to do, ultimately. But there is there is an outcome or a consequence, which is fundamental freedom. We're exploring and learning about more freedom. And, you know, sometimes the freedom is scary, as we'll be exploring. In fact, we'll go to that.
There are a lot of nice passages. I don't have the book in front of me. It's better for me not to try to read right now, but because I have an eye issue at the moment. But someone could find them. They're about balancing the practice so that you don't regard this as a prison and this as an escape. And there are quite a few of them in this chapter and worth going after. I think you underlined some of them. And other people have books.
All right. If you cultivate, I kind of started
with
my,
to this for
112, last whole paragraph. You are eating and drinking, no doubt having a relatively pleasant time, and you regard it as completely outside of what you are doing in the meditation hall. This is dichotomy, a shockingly big contrast, which is unnecessary. If you cultivate such an approach during the mealtime or during personal time, thinking that this is your free time and your time to release energy, then obviously your sitting practice is going to feel like imprisonment. You're creating your own jail.
And that's really important to notice when we actually get up from our meditation practice. If we actually pay attention, close attention to the shift that occurs between sitting and actually, you know, when we have these moments of completely being present, and then how there's this thing that happens. And now I can do what I want, or who knows what we go through, but we go through this shift of thinking, it's different.
Jail and freedom.
Yeah, and so you can be oppressive, or you could, contrary-wise, think, I'm going into jail now. I just experienced my freedom on the cushion, and now I got to go through this samsara jungle, right? I mean, either way, we're shifting. And what is that shift? I think this would be a very interesting challenge for all of us to do, you know, as we practice, as we do our own personal practice at home or do a group practice, is watching the shift that occurs. So we've got to go home tonight. What's going to happen when we go out the door? You know, watch where our mind goes. Very interesting homework, we'll call it. Because this is where we actually learn about the integration of the meditation practice and the rest of our life. And that's critical. This is almost a rehearsal, the meditation practice, for living the rest of our life. Yes?
Something I was wondering, I think I've just been away for a couple of weeks, and before going away, I found meditating on these thoughts, and then you're not meditating on these thoughts, and then driving out these thoughts. Oh, they're always there. Get the hell out of here. And, you know, then you go away in some place where you don't have to think about anything but what you're doing right
there.
Yeah. Other than the leaves. And doing a lot of birding and stuff like that. So it's very much in the moment stuff. And then I realized upon coming back, you know, I did some meditating, but I considered every moment really a meditation. And then I thought, when coming back, I am not going to let my mind take over again. I felt too, what did you say, that neurotic bundle screaming for attention? It was too much. And so I don't know if this is legitimate or anybody's ever tried, but I thought, I'm going to try to spend as much of my non-meditating time meditating.
Yeah.
Good
idea.
Yeah.
Capital.
And try to do it.
Capital
and
idea.
And it's
capital idea.
That people do that.
People do that.
People like you.
No, it's good you discovered this for yourself.
I discovered this for myself.
So, I mean, I think, for instance, one of the things that happens, like, you know, you're at work, and because you're at work, you're sort of slugging away, and you have to be. You're focused on a computer or something, just stop and take 1 second or 3 seconds and just either look out the window if you've got a window, or just basically look up into space and give yourself that chance to just sort of, you know, it's a way to check in. So if you do enough of that, and you begin to see an integration. There's a
flash. I mean, we covered some.
Yeah, we talked about flashing. So it's simply a flash. We talked about flashing before, and I think what you've discovered for yourself, or made an aspiration for yourself, is wonderful.
At least for now. I mean, I don't know how long.
This is all that matters. We're talking about only where you are right now, and that's what.
Well,
matters.
Then I started berating myself for looking for results.
Once you do that, you're not meditating. But you're not meditating anymore when you do that. Well, we're looking for results.
If you're going to spend your non-meditating time meditating, which is great. Then you can spend some meditating time non-meditating. that's the whole evening out. That there are three or four passages here that talk about that.
Well, there's another term called non-meditation. And actually, non-meditation does not mean an absence of meditation. But it means, non-meditation means kind of constant. Everything is meditation. Everything fundamentally is, and therefore there's no break. There's no session and no break.
Yeah.
There's no difference between I'm going to go sit now and I'm going to get up and do something else. It's complete totality of meditation. It's called non-meditation.
I guess that, yeah, that's part of it, because when you're on vacation and you're doing the kind of thing that you're very aware of how you're doing something in the moment. And, you know, yeah, so it's true. Tie your shoes that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that's nothing new, really, but
it's all new.
No,
it's all new.
New.
It's completely new.
Yeah.
And that's where we're going now, and it completely connects with this next chapter, Meditation in the Fourth Moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But now, doesn't traveling have lots of anxieties?
Not too many.
No? No moment of anxiety?
Well, some, but it's exciting. I'm not sure what you're asking.
You had mentioned before in traveling, the reason it was good is because it allows you to actually see things differently, not in the mundane way that you see every day. And I think that that's what a lot of people go for.
And to actually be in the moment that whatever anxiety you have, it's like, okay, we have to deal with this thing at the airport or whatever, and just do it. I mean,
no
sense in getting.
I think it's about the shift of environment. So when your environment changes, at least you have this momentary kind of sense of fresh take, and you know you're not just sort of going through your motions, which you begin a new routine, you know.
Yeah.
And so when we actually take a trip somewhere, we have to. Now, for some people, that's really bad. I mean, they can't stand having their routine upset. But for other people, it's an adventure.
Yeah.
And that's the difference of mentality.
Yeah.
But no matter what, whether it's fun or actually difficult, it's still good because it's a shift out of familiarity.
Yeah.
And our familiarization is oftentimes what really gets us back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think we really know what we're doing. We think we really understand what's happening here. So this fourth moment is a very interesting term.
So just before you go on, so I guess what I'm making of this whole touch of touch and go isn't just for meditation. It's for all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. And I want to point out that this book is called Mindfulness in Action.
Yeah.
So it's really, the first part is more about teaching us about what mindfulness is from different angles, but the whole point of this book is carrying your meditation into the world.
Mm-hmm.
You're awake mind.
And so when we mention
that's my favorite book. Oh, good.
Well, when we mention the notion that this has been kind of a meditation practice, been kind of a rehearsal, that's precisely what it is.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we can get to a point where we have to start with some sense of isolation and so that we can discover the basic non-distraction. But then we want to take that out with us. We're going to basically meet the world with non-distraction.
Somewhere down the line, we had read along the lines that what you're saying, when you're on the cushion, the thinking is not an intruder, it's the actual instructor. And you know, when you switch gears, you kind of see how the thoughts kind of creep up on you in the same way that they do when you're on the cushion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and on the cushion, suddenly you just discover yourself in the middle of a thought. You have no idea how you got there. You know, I mean, this is usually what happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very few of us are as adept to really know precisely when thought actually starts to emerge. We simply find ourselves in the middle of it. That's my experience, anyway. So, you know, of course, when we're functioning out in the world where we have a different kind of dynamic, we have all these various elements that we have to pay attention to. But bringing this kind of openness that we are learning how to develop and some sense of awareness to where we are, which is what we're learning about, starts to change how we actually see what we're doing in the world. And so one of the key factors here is this thing called the fourth moment. I don't know if you've heard of the fourth moment before. I don't remember. Did we discuss it?
We discussed it.
Yeah. So basically, fourth moment is beyond past, present, and future. What we call present is like present circumstances. And so, of course, if the present circumstances are shifting rapidly, such as in travel, we're going to be much more attentive to them, right? But we're talking now about something else, which is regardless of whether we go anywhere or stay here in the same room for 15 or 20 years, we're looking at something else that's connected with awareness itself, which is fundamentally open space and timelessness, you could say. The fourth moment is really timelessness because it's completely unconditioned. It's completely, it's absolutely unstructured in any way. So, you know, it's happening all the time and we simply don't acknowledge it. Right? But there are moments when, you know, things happen and, you know, suddenly there's a gap and, you know, like you could call them epiphanies. They occasionally happen and, you know, suddenly there's a space, you know. Could be shocking, it could be, you know, cause for some sense of celebration, but the fundamental thing is it's just open. It's completely open. And it's like, suddenly it's like we've never been here before. So this is the holy truth. You want to know.
But the underlying experience is always the fourth moment.
That's it.
Yes.
That, you know, because it's so much here. You go, huh? You know, hey, what's that, right? I mean, you know, I gotta like pay attention to, you know, who's coming in the door, what I think about this person over there, or they don't look at me the way I want them to look at me, you know, and whatever else, all my stuff, you know, about. Experience. But this is kind of beyond experience.
Could I read a little bit?
Yes.
This is on page 117.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll start with now because
this
paragraph is really, I think, gives a lot of the main point. Mm-hmm. Nowness in this sense is very similar to the fourth moment, which was introduced in chapter 8, the present moment. This term, the fourth moment, may sound more mystical than what is meant. You have the past, present, and future, which are the three moments. Then you have something else taking place, a gap in time, which is called the fourth moment. The fourth moment is not a far-out or extraordinary experience. It is a state of experience that doesn't even belong to now. It doesn't belong to what might be either. It belongs to a non-category. We have to call it something, however. Thus, it is called the fourth moment. The fourth moment is the state of non-ego, going beyond the limitations of your habitual self. It is a very real experience, an overwhelming experience, in which nothing can be misunderstood. It is sometimes called the knowledge of egoless insight. The experience comes at you rather than you searching for it.
And that, I think, is the key point, is that it's egoless, and so our habit is to coat our experience with this identity. And, you know, this whole game of, you know, going back and forth about me and you or this and that, I and other. And so that's this sort of like, it doesn't partake of that at all. And so, you know, by ungluing ourselves to this habit of me and you or them, we start to become much more open and see how available this is. We're making ourselves available to it. This is where we really connect. And the other side of this is speaking it from a point of view of, we started studying Pema Chodron and the notion of compassion. this is one of the elements, a major element of what compassion is this openness. Because at that point we really are available to what's going on, really, what's really happening, or what is really beyond just people self-carrying themselves and undoing their stuff and projecting on each other.
And openness really does mean dropping that ego.
Yes.
Great. This all makes a lot of sense. Although I feel like throwing out a wild card here.
Yeah. Good.
Race. Like racism.
What about it?
How would, how would he have looked at that? I mean, I can see, the compassion and being able to see the larger vision, of it. However, we're in a time now where there's just a lot of that stuff that's up.
You're talking about I and other. You're talking about right.
So I just wanted to. I mean, I think I know the answer to that, but I'm curious as to. I thought I'd just throw out the wild card of race.
Could you be more specific?
Yeah. What's on your mind?
Well, when you're in a space where there are people who, and recently I read the book Citizen. I don't know if you've read it by Claudia Rankine, and it really is talking about, it's not just now, it's like stuff that people are walking around with history and, a state of, past and present and future, how to unravel that kind of pain.
Okay, so we have to take responsibility for where we are now. Mm-hmm. We cannot take responsibility for what happened 200 years ago or 500 years ago. But we have capacity to do this now. In the situation that you find yourself, you have the capacity to be authentic or respond authentically to the situations that arise. We all have that capacity. And if there's any thing, we're not just doing this, we're not just sitting around here talking about meditation, doing these practices just to, for ourselves alone. I mean, certainly one of the key points is to be able to go beyond ourselves and be able to help each other and serve each other. And that also can mean being engaged in society. But I mean, we have to start with where we are. We can't go off and just with this big white banner on a white horse saying, I'm going to help everybody and clean up people's messes for them. We can't do that.
Yeah.
So why did you bring...
But, I mean, one thing I was thinking about is what I found with bringing the meditation practice off the cushion is to have an awareness of when I have that bias.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that we're aware that I'll be walking on the street and notice, like, I just made a judgment about that person because they're black, that I didn't think about the person before them who was white. And I have no reason to do that. But my mind is trained to be that way. And so that a piece of the openness is to notice that and know that that's what we've been trained to do. That's what years of living in society does to us, and so that you have to see that that's a piece of what happens. That's what the mind does, and then know, like, that's just like all the other stories that my mind tells me, and I don't have to believe it. It's just like Michael said, don't believe everything you think. So we have to acknowledge that we had the thought. And I think that's the piece that can be hard, because we want to know, I don't see any difference. And like, that's just like, if you're blind, yes, you don't see any difference.
You can say that all you want, and you're still thinking it.
Right.
So, and this is the problem. But there's a very interesting point here where, you know, we're dealing with very uncomfortable moments here
mm-hmm.
of actually seeing our mind making these kind of distinctions, even though we could say we know better.
Mm-hmm.
We have a much more kind of higher predisposition towards acknowledging. But at the same time, here we are, and we're encountering this kind of thing. And, you know, so I have to tell you something. This does not go away, you know. And if one of the problems is we are talking about human predicament. But, you know, this human predicament is essential to waking up. If we don't have, I mean, we actually need this predicament on some level, because it's what shakes us out of this sleep. One of the very important things here, I don't know how if I'm jumping too far ahead here, but I do just want to mention that there's this question about being haunted by...
okay.
Well, we're looking at... It starts on page 118 and 119. You know, you can't just sort of...
Why don't you read it?
All right. Experiencing the fourth moment, first of all, the moment is the essence, the fourth moment is the moment of essence of insight and awareness. Experience becomes so real and precise that it transcends any reference point of any doctrine that you are practicing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you are practicing mindfulness, Christianity, Buddhism, or psychology, you are practicing life. In fact, ironically, you find that you can't escape. You find that life is practicing you. It becomes so real and obvious. And it's very important, it's critically important in terms of the development of meditative awareness. So, at this point he starts talking about how everything starts to haunt you. And this haunting can be really, really difficult. It can take the form of pleasurable confirmation, and sometimes being painful and threatening, but it doesn't leave you alone. It's like... you can't get rid of it. You can't call someone to exercise it. You don't want to either, which is really important. You should understand this is a precious experience to actually acknowledge and honor. So he's talking about how you're sitting at the razor's edge, making campfires quite happily, and yet knowing you're on the razor's edge. You can't quite just settle down and build your campfire and roast marshmallows. I mean, the whole storyline just is... all shattered with something else. There's something else. And there's something else. So this state of hauntedness is the state of ego, actually. This is very interesting. Somebody in your internal mental family, some part of your being is beginning to complain that they are getting uncomfortable messages. The awareness of the fourth moment cannot materialize unless there is that slight tinge of being haunted by your own egotism. That hauntedness of ego and egoless insight work together. That is what creates our experience. I'd like you to really consider that paragraph as a point of contemplation, at least for a while, and consider how important it is to work with and honor the very predicament we find ourselves in. So, if we're finding ourselves dealing with an uncomfortable perception, we realize we're right on the edge of waking up. This is actually where the rubber can hit the road.
You can see when that happens, then you see your own mind, and then you can open into the space. When you were talking, it reminded me of coming back from when you were on the bus, and I had my computer, which is new. Michael didn't want me to take, but I took it, and my iPad and my phone, and I had to go to the bathroom in the back of the bus, and I'm thinking, okay, now I'm going to just leave my world right here, and there's a black guy in the seat across from me. So my first thought was, oh, maybe this isn't safe, but it was only because he was black. So and I saw my mind, and it went right there, and I say that honestly, and then I thought, well, wait, you know. So, I mean, it was, I just cleared it, and I realized that was just an imagination and a being conditioned over so long that way. So it was just so clear. But that's when you have a choice. Then you can drop it,
or you can see if there's a problem or whatever. But I think there's just, I might not have noticed if I hadn't really, you know, been more aware of what goes through my mind. I really saw it. It was vivid.
Yeah, I mean, these racial stereotypes are actually, in our country in particular, are really, really triggers. And, you know, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
And they're very deeply rooted in our culture and how we take everything for granted, our language, you know, all of our basic way of life built around this. Claudia Rankine, she's a very interesting lady. She's a poet, I know. I listened to this program after I get in the car and go home from this class. What's it called? This guy, Christopher Wise. Yeah, and she's on there a lot and reciting her poems and talking about her experience and how utterly crazy this is. But for all of us, this is not only our issue, it's everybody's issue. And so if you're sitting on the other side of this, it's also the opportunity. I mean, one lady I know who died, Abba McCarthy, yeah, who was a very powerful woman, yeah, from Jamaica, who was actually a princess and carried herself with great, you know, she had a great kind of just presence. And she was totally angry. She'd won, she'd earned all these various degrees, gotten received honorary degrees from universities all over the world. And she's sitting here in Cambridge and just fuming at, you know, she said she was one of the first people to do a three and a half or four year retreat, Buddhist retreat on her own. And, you know, why aren't we able to engage and bring in the black community? I mean, this is actually a very important issue. So, you know, I mean, I just took it from her because she would beat me over the head when I came to visit her. You know, it wasn't a pleasant experience.
No.
Yeah, like, but honestly, this is one of our issues we have to cope with. So, I think the important thing is that this paragraph, I'm hoping, at least for me, I'm using this as a key point. It really hit the nail on the head for how critical it is that we work with this. And we do work with it, and we're open, we're willing to be open at all costs. So, I want to hear more questions right now if this is provoking anything on your part, on anybody's part here. Feel free to say anything. Yeah, Harry.
Bob. So the frequency of you know, the flashes.
Yeah.
Would you call it, say, and it picks up in frequency, would you call that simultaneous mind?
Call it?
Simultaneous mind. Well, it seems like a duality, but some people see it as actually what I think you mentioned. You get, you know, somebody mentioned that it becomes so frequent, so habitual that you are getting these flashes, let's say, these awareness sparks, that it becomes simultaneous with your being dealing with the details of life.
Well, he says, like, actually, in the next paragraph, he talks about how we can't really have no way of knowing where we are in our practice or how we are doing on the path of mindfulness as far as some standard evaluation is concerned. We do know we started on our journey, and the journey is continuing, and the journey takes time, and so all you're doing is being there and working with that. I mean, yes. What happens is, I think, that rather than an occasional flash or pop, you know, as we practice more, we connect the dots, so it becomes more of a continuity.
Mm-hmm. I love and yet I'm also disturbed but appreciative of the fact that the fourth moment doesn't need reassurance.
Oh, absolutely. It is completely beyond any need to, it doesn't have any concerns about whether anybody gets it or not. It's not knocking you on the head, say, here I am, you know, and that's, if it were, it would be possibly easier for us deadheads to actually figure it out, because it is the underlying basis.
Maybe you want to mention something about the totality. What is that?
All right. Bottom of page 120. The fourth moment, he's saying that the present is the third moment. It has a sense of presence, being here. I mean, when we're just sitting here looking at the floor in our meditation, we are just here and that is all, right? Period. Blah. The fourth moment, on the other hand, is a state of totality and total awareness that doesn't need reassurance. It is happening. It is there. You feel the totality. You perceive not only the beam of light from the flashlight,
but your mindfulness
of all the space all around you at the same time. So it's a much larger vision of the a much larger version of the present. The experience of the fourth moment sharpens your intelligence. Without this experience of egoless insight, you may just accept things naively, and such naivete may be the basis for self-deception. You turn on the cold shower and you expect everything to be okay. Everything seems to be predictable, and then you are not prepared for any reminders. Then this little twist of hot water takes place coming in, completely knocks you out, you know. Suddenly there's this shock. So I think that we need these reminders. And here he's saying something so important. If there is a reminder, everything becomes very real. If you don't have any reminders, you are at the mercy of chaos and confusion. The sitting practice of meditation provides constant reminders, and that's why it's so important. It boils down to that. So, I mean, in other words, all we are, you know, in our just default state is basically operating on automatic and in a state of total chaos. Which we call normal. Right?
Yeah.
And if we get very reactive to it, we're called abnormal. Because we're not accepting that norm. You know? And so, what we're doing here is learning how to get out of the whole system. The system is basically entrapment. It is basically believing that this is real.
Would you equate reminders to problems or obstacles?
Any kind of problem, any kind of irritation is basically any kind of disturbance, any kind of factor that, you know, makes one ill at ease is actually the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Let the poison be the medicine.
Yes.
All right.
I want to hear from Mariah.
I have a couple of things. This is personal. Just one is that I've been lately experiencing a lot of irritability, and when I look at the irritability, it's always sick. It doesn't matter what it is. It's always something that I really don't care about. It doesn't matter to me why I feel irritable about that, etc. And I realize that the irritability is in here, and that it's covering this layer of discomfort and fear and confusion, like as you said, the vomitorium, you know? And that I would rather feel angry than feel that.
It's easier, right?
But it's easier, because I feel a little bit powerful. Yeah. I don't like vulnerability, you know?
Well, if you're on a high horse, you know, if you're particularly in a self-justified anger or feel like you have a right to be angry about something.
Well, then that's the second thing, you know, because in terms of being haunted, okay, I think I've been haunted my whole life, but lately I'm haunted not only by just how awful I am, but the entire human race, you know, because I'm really mad at them for what we're doing to the planet. And I have a hard time separating that, because I'm one of them too. You know? So, the question I have is that this gets really close to my self-hatred. And I need to keep separating out the haunting of, you know, the human condition and seeing it that way, as opposed to I'm this awful person that when I meditate, all I can do is see my mind try to take advantage of every single situation, like, and get it for myself or push it away or, you know, manipulate it, control it.
You wouldn't do that if you didn't love yourself in the first place.
You think?
Sure. I mean, how can you hate yourself without loving yourself? You know? I mean, that's where the self-hatred comes from, is self-love.
Really?
What? And we call it, and you can even get whack off the love and hatred and just call it self.
Self.
Me.
Self. Yeah. I think the surface emotions that you're talking about, the hatred, there is an underbelly of the bubbling of more vulnerability underneath there. That sometimes I feel I generally don't go in the hate zone so much as maybe some other emotions, but underneath that, generally it feels as if I open this up, this is going to be a big old floodgate. So let me keep my cap on it,
right,
and let me control this in little spurts, as opposed to if I go for this man, there's a whole river coming out. So,
or maybe there's no more. Maybe there's no more me.
That I don't worry about, actually. But it does. It feels like I've got a cap on it. And okay, I've got to contain this somehow. And I've got to, you know, look at this and, you know, digest it slowly. We're getting back to the digestion. Just slowly, as opposed to really letting it go through the whole intestinal process.
That's not bad, though.
No.
What we are talking about...
It's just an awareness of what I do.
Think about something, really, an easy way to treat this is no indulgence.
K-N-O-W?
No.
N-O.
Indulgence. We don't indulge. So if I'm angry, I'm going to be angry. But then there's a question of how, of going into this indulgence mode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that point, you're feeding the fire.
Yes.
At that point, you're throwing, basically, all hell starts to break loose because you're indulging. If we're training with this letting go, we're training with this complete dropping it at the same time. Seeing it, opening up and dropping it. And that's why we want to be able to do that. We don't want to get ourselves in a situation where we're over our heads, where we're lost with this complete eruption, like some volcano going off. You know, so we do this by just treating ourselves one thought at a time, or as Winston Churchill said in the bathroom, one turd at a time, you know. No, this is the famous turd of his. Oh yeah, he was in the bathroom smoking a cigar, you know, and somebody rushes in. This is when he was prime minister. Mr. Prime Minister, we have to have you sign this right now. You know, this is something that has to go out immediately. And this puff of smoke coming through the toilet says, "I only deal with one turd at a time." Sorry.
I'm reminded of
that.
Well, we're going to dedicate the merit. So, let's do that. And we'll have plenty to think about and talk about next week. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Thank you for the laugh.
We're going to basically dedicate the merit we do this, because it's not enough that we simply have this opportunity to explore and understand and learn more about our own Buddha nature and reality itself, but it's basically always dedicated to greater reality beyond us.